upset. I went to the VA yesterday. I blew a fuse. The women's clinic is about a third the size. I mean, for real? So what? Another area needed more space. It's not like we have a lot of space to begin with. It just shows me that women are not a priority.
In some places, it is still a work in progress. It is a huge start to have so many women clinics now, but so much more needs to be done. Well, it may be a small clinic where I go, NCFC San Antonio, Texas, but my physician is great. I am so grateful for her and for all the VA medical care I receive. But I agree that the VA lacks, as a whole, in care for women.
At the Philadelphia VA Medical Center, the clinic is small, but the plans are for a bigger one to be built and will provide all the services from A to Z and separate from the male veterans. The women's clinic has been setting up meetings for us to voice our concerns and ask what needs to be improved. Ask your clinic to do the same. My biggest problem is the mental health clinic, where I can be seen every other week and for 30 minutes. My biggest issue is my PTSD. At that rate, it will take years for me to be in a good place. The VA also needs to train all staff to treat women vets with more respect and listen to our needs. It is not in our heads. My other big problem is that there is only one counselor at any of the vet centers in this area who can handle MST, military sexual trauma. Such a huge area and with lots of women vets, and this is what we have? I am so over being told that women are new to the VA system. BS! Lots of us have served and have been using the VA for years. Get over it and fix the problem. We are over the excuses.
I'd like to know where all the MDs are. The new women's clinic at the VA here has a nurse practitioner. My psychiatrist is a nurse practitioner. I know the VA hires doctors, or used to. Is it just me, or do you see some major discrimination going on here?
I see a woman doctor, but my husband sees her too, along with many other male veterans. So the waiting room is full of mostly guys when you go to wait on your appointment.
I've heard about the ogling from men veterans and experienced it. I'm amazed. You'd think they never saw the other half of the species before.
I guess our scarcity makes us ogleable.
And if you need to have a pap smear, my woman doctor makes a big deal out of it as if she has never done one before. Also, if you are admitted to the Harry S. Truman Memorial Veterans Hospital, you may find yourself sharing a two-bedroom with a male veteran.
We have a nice women's clinic here at American Lake VA in Tacoma. But again, two nurse practitioners, not MDs.
In the Houston clinic? I went to that for almost 6 years. Very hard to get into, and the doctor I saw there was cold and brash with me. There was no women's clinic in Chicago or Cincinnati. Albuquerque had one, but it was open one or two afternoons a week and staffed by a nurse practitioner. The Tampa clinic is fully staffed with female doctors, psychiatrists, GYNs, etc.
My uneducated guess is that every regional office dances to their own beat. And that is wrong. If enough women start saying something and unite, the VA will wake up out of its out-of-touch coma concerning female vets. The VA counts on women not saying anything and believing that they need to settle for less. Wrong. There should be a high and consistent standard of service at every VA facility, but that's in a perfect world.
Hi, this is Patricia Lee Stotter and Marcia Rock. And we're with the documentary Service, Disabled Women Veterans in Transition. And I just want to begin by saying that everyone who has done any research about women's veteran advocacy learns about Susan Avalos Smith. Thank you so much, Susan, for speaking with Marcia and me.
Oh, I'm happy to help.
I have learned through my social networking and the women we've spoken to and the women we're working with in our project, that you are the person who can help women navigate their way through, around, under, outside the VA to get the care and the services they deserve. Having said that, I would like to ask you just a touch about yourself, which is, can you just tell us when you served and how you started doing what you're doing now?
I served in the U.S. Army from 1991 to 1995 as a Chinese linguist. And during the time that I was in, I witnessed, to my horror, a lot of things that weren't being done by the book. And when I got out, I immediately landed into a women's trauma recovery program support group in Seattle at the VA. And I found out that there were many people who didn't understand how the system worked. And there were even two people within that group that worked at the VA, one at the regional office and one at the medical center. And I just thought, you know, it's time to put our heads together, because the opportunity for women to network and to get this information is pretty much zero. So once I learned how the system worked, then it was like sharing that so people didn't have to reinvent the wheel.
Hopefully, our conversation with you will continue that mission. When you first started supporting other women, what kind of trauma were they dealing with?
All of them were dealing with military sexual trauma.
And how was that manifested in the experiences of the women you got to know and who you helped get help?
They could fill out paperwork for someone else, but not their own. They weren't able to advocate for themselves, but they were able to advocate for other people. And they were pretty much isolated and didn't participate in any community at all.
You're saying they took care of other women, but they couldn't take care of themselves. What do you think that's about?
I think it's about the emotion that we carry with us regarding our own trauma. And I think people have this concept that you have to convince someone that this happened rather than you need to fill the paperwork out correctly and the trauma happened.
When we had a conversation with Velma Hart, she talked about how she is still finding women from the Vietnam War who are suddenly getting in touch with traumas or PTSD as well as MST. And it's many, many years later that they're finally learning how much they've been suffering. Do you find that to be the case?
Yeah, that's the rule rather than the exception. Most of the women that come to me are 20 or 30 years out, and I have women as far back as World War II. PTSD is not something you can figure out by yourself. It's probably not until your life completely crumbles that you are forced to reach out for help. And most women going in the military are very independent and resourceful, and so they're able to manage just about everything. And this is one thing that you can't manage by yourself.
So what are the options women have, and how do you encourage them to fill out their own forms? And does the VA have a way to help that process?
Well, there's not a lot of options, and I don't encourage them to fill out their own forms. I fill the forms out for them. And that's probably the biggest service that I offer, because I know which forms and what needs to be said, and I try to do that with the least amount of emotional trauma to them. And part of the problem is that the forms for filing for military sexual trauma are different than filing for any other service-connected claim. That being said, that doesn't mean that the people who are working at the VA know that. And that is the main problem, that MST is kind of treated like gravel rash. If you don't take care of it, you've got a huge scar and a lot of problems, and you're going to need to go back in there and clean it out, and it's really painful, but you're going to end up healing with less of a scar.
Once they fill out the form, what benefits do they get to help them with the MST?
First of all, they're entitled to all health care without filling out the forms. And that's part of what people at the VA don't know. Anybody with military sexual trauma can go into a VA and request mental health care or any kind of care related to the sexual assault. They have an STD, if they have a broken jaw, if whatever's related to that, they're entitled to. They have to enroll at some point, but they're already entitled to that by federal mandate from 1992. And that's the difference between all the other cases. Once the benefit paperwork is filled out, then they're entitled to financial compensation and other types of benefits, depending on their service-connected percentage, such as sending their children to college or getting health care for family members, things like that.
A lot of the women that we've spoken to in the process of making the film and just meeting women through Facebook and other ways, they talk about different levels of military sexual trauma. And just to have our listeners understand better, one thing I noticed was that a lot of the younger women kind of dismissed their military sexual trauma by saying, oh, it was pretty benign. I could shut it down. The guys would speak rudely or sexually to me over and over, and I finally told them to stop. And I want to ask you a question. When I hear these young women speaking that way, I'm wondering, are you just so far out of touch with your feelings of what happened with you that you don't know it yet? Or do you think things are beginning to improve for these women who are, you know, with many, many, many men around them in an institution made by and for men for the most part?
Well, to me, it sounds like you're talking to younger women who have just recently served and they're applying their military bearing, suck it up and drive on. And, you know, everybody's idea of what is just the regular kind of harassment varies greatly. And I think, you know, each time you need to ask, because I was just stunned one time by a nurse who was saying, you know, she's like, oh, it's no big deal. But, yeah, the bus that we had to take to go to work every morning, the guy was masturbating, and, you know, that went on for 2 years. And to her, that was just a regular kind of sexual harassment. But that's not really probably the general public's opinion of regular sexual harassment.
What would you say in general for the level of VA service now and how women are being helped?
Well, I'd have to preface that with every single VA is different. Some are more progressive than others, and I think it's up to the highest ranking member to set the tone. So you'll see everything from, you know, they really don't care to, oh, well, we're going to make a women's clinic and we're going to have a separate door so you don't have to be ogled while you're walking through the hospital. They've made changes. They're trying to make changes. Now they're forced to make changes. And the budget is just not there. And the people are burning out at such a high rate, the counselors and therapists, that they can't replace them quickly enough. And right now, my understanding, most people who even are suicidal can only be seen once a month because they don't have enough people to help.
And that's because of budget or plan, do you think?
Mostly budget, partly plan, and partly just, you know, the inability to manage staff properly. I mean, we don't have a full-time doctor here for the women's clinic, and that means that even though we have the clinic, if there's not a doctor there, they have to go to the regular emergency room walk-in, which means that they have to sit with the guys. And most women will just get up and leave. They will not get medical care.
One interesting thing that came up repeatedly as a complaint was that women felt they were seeing nurse practitioners rather than doctors. And I actually spoke to a physician about this who pointed out that nurse practitioners can, when they're working in concert well with physicians, provide an opportunity for a medical care model that is fantastic, and that people need to know that if you don't like your nurse practitioner, it's not because she's not good. And it puts women in the position of actually sounding quite sexist themselves. Have you seen any of these systems where the nurse practitioners do work well in concert with the physicians and create a more comfortable environment for veterans?
I have, but part of the problem of the VA is that they have residents working there, and so the turnover is pretty high. So it's not possible for these relationships to develop and continue. It's constantly changing and being challenged.
You're just making me realize I've heard a lot of people talk about this combination of a teaching hospital and a VA together, like the one on 23rd Street in New York City. It probably is one teaching physician with residents who come through.
So wouldn't a nurse practitioner be a stable person? That would make it a benefit to have?
Yes, it could be. And it could be that the nurse practitioner knows much more than the doctor about a lot of things, but they also don't have the power to make the changes either. So it's a difficult situation.
For vets who are listening to this, who are struggling to figure out how to work with the VA, what are some steps that they should take to get the service they need?
The first thing is never take no for an answer, because it's probably that the person doesn't know. And the second thing is never go to the first line person. Don't just walk in the VA and go to the front desk and say, you know, I have MST, I need to be seen. They'll just say, oh, well, you're not service connected, you can't go here until you file a claim, blah, blah, blah. And so that is the problem. The gatekeepers are the problem, because they're not told that men and women who have MST can be seen just by saying, I have MST. So contact a social worker first. Contact the women's program manager first and meet them and have them walk you through the process of getting into mental health care.
So how do you find the name of a social worker or the program manager?
There's a list of all of the VA facilities on the VA.gov site, to include vet centers and community outreach clinics. So you don't even need to have the name. You just call the main number and say, I want to speak to the women's program manager.
So make a phone call first.
That would help, yeah.
And what about the contact page on the VA that if you send in a complaint or a question, they'll answer you within one day? Is that a way to get help?
It could be, but I think you need to find a real person that you can use for probably the first year or two of your going to the VA, that you can talk to, who knows the rules and regulations and can help guide you through that. And a lot of the work that I do is just explaining how the VA works, that there's the medical center side, there's the regional office administrative side, and then there's the veterans benefit side. And if you think that all of those people should and do talk to each other, you're wrong. So understanding the system is huge, because I have people who call me up and say, well, I just went to the VA and they said blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, what do you mean by the VA? You know, and after half an hour, it turns out, oh, they went to somebody completely different, because they don't understand the system.
And what's the difference between a state VA and a federal VA?
The state VA will have special programs for the veterans in that state. For example, in Washington State, we have a list of contract mental health workers for PTSD, and they are not working at the VA. They're working in their offices and supporting the veterans in the local communities. So that would be one of the things that Washington State has. And every state has different benefits. So you need to look on the state site to see what that is. And the federal VA is essentially the same across the board. So
you have to approach the state and the federal to get the full service.
You have to. Yes. You should approach them to get full services. And most people don't know that they should.
And the people who need it the most are the people possibly least able to tolerate that level of frustration. And
Right. That's
why people like you exist, and why I'm sitting here having a fantasy about one of the things on our website being a map with every state, and we kind of tell you the secret tunnels to how to get in.
Well, yeah, it's not really a secret. You go in the side door or the back door. It's not a secret. Because if you want to get anything done, you have to find a point of contact who gets it, who understands MST, who understands the system, and what works and what doesn't within that system. It could be somebody who works at the VA, and it could be a veteran who's been going to that particular VA for a long time and knows that VA and knows who the good contacts are and knows who the bad contacts are.
Now, I would like to ask you, as we wind down, an enormously general question, but I'm very interested in your response. And I would like to know how you feel the issue of MST, don't ask, don't tell, how you deal with sexuality and Eros in an institution that is dealing with death and everything that Eros is not about and yet highly charged. Do you see a relationship between these issues? Do you have a feeling about it?
Well, the VA does not have a problem with the don't ask, don't tell. The only thing that I tell people that they really ought to do is have an advance directive with their person with their name on it, so that if they do go to the hospital, that person is allowed to go in and sit with them. Because if you don't have that done, you can't get in to see your veteran. And you should have that anyway, but particularly if you don't have a husband or a wife, VA gets touchy about that. But they don't care if you're a lesbian and you're wanting to receive care. There's no law or something that would prevent them, as there is in the military, from saying anything about that, and there's no punishment that goes with that. There are cultural kind of problems with certain people in certain areas, but usually that doesn't prevent you from getting the care. There's a lot of transgendered people who have been assaulted and have come into the system, and they do have to fight a little bit harder, but again, once you find a point of contact that can lead you, that's all you really need for the VA. As far as the military goes, I think right now the whole don't ask, don't tell is kind of absurd, but the fact is that the people who are going around raping others are the heterosexual men, not the homosexual men. You might as well have people in there who are concerned about their sexuality to keep it to themselves.
What do you think, since you've been dealing with this a lot and know so much about it, might be a solution for the controlling the military sexual trauma?
First of all, Congress has to change the policies that they're writing, because they've created SAPRO, SARC, this whole program, which essentially does nothing. They have no power, they have no voice, they have no authority to change anything within the military system. So it's just lip service. So they need to go in there and they need to hold people accountable. They need to hold the commanders accountable. Every MST case goes to the command. So it's handled at the command level. There needs to be a standard policy. There needs to be oversight with either a commander from another unit that they don't know come in and do the paperwork and help the victim. And then they also need to look at doing something serious with the perpetrators, because it's, you know, oh, well, yeah, he drugged her and then raped her and then put it on YouTube, but we're just going to give him a $125 fine. Like, I'm sorry. The fine doesn't match the crime. So typically the military will go after the victim. They have something called the McDowell checklist that most CID, NCIS, OIS uses for their investigative procedures for handling a rape case. That needs to go, because that was created specifically to show the victim is lying. And even if you're telling the truth, it will show the victim is lying. So the victim will be charged with conduct unbecoming, filing false charges, and if the victim or the perpetrator is married at the time of the assault, they will typically try to charge the victim with adultery. And that's a 26-year sentence in the military institution. There's no conversation between command, Congress, and the criminal justice system to show that, first, the crime is not being handled properly, then the victim is not being handled properly because they're not getting the care that they need. And it's however the commander chooses to handle it. So there's no standard. And then Congress needs to step in and say, okay, you know, if you don't handle a rape case well, it's going to either reflect on your OER, the Officer's Evaluation Report, which is an annual part of the military, or they're going to be kicked out.
I read something recently that was very interesting, I thought, and completely off. They were talking about the classically feminine traits of taking care of others first, not wanting to use power with sex in an oppressive fashion. And it was a long argument leading up to the fact that they felt that women really shouldn't be in the military. And my reaction was that there should be the same proportion of women in the military that there are in our society. I think it's 52% now. I think maybe a lot of these issues you're talking about would shift. How do you feel about how able women are to move into more powerful positions these days and perhaps change the culture?
Well, I had a very unusual experience in the Army, because I was in a class that was half women. And it was a different situation. We were all in the language schools, so it wasn't like an infantry base where women were banned. And I think, you know, some of the cultures, you know, infantry, they always, it's like, hey, ladies, and that's supposed to be, you know, something derogatory when they're talking to the guys. Just things like that, you know, they perpetuated within the armor divisions, the artillery divisions, all of these places where it's just men. But I think where there are a lot of women, it's become the norm, and it's not as much of a problem. But I think, you know, with the military sexual assault training, prevention training, you know, they focus on women, and they don't say that, you know, well, there's a lot of men that are assaulted as well. And, you know, so they think it's the woman's fault. And as far as women going in the military, I don't see that there's a problem with them serving. I think there's a problem with how the command handles it, because they can just pick and choose and apply rules and regulations as they feel that they want to. And that really bothers me.
Going back to how to affect change, do you see anyone in Congress now advocating for these changes in MST?
There are people who are working with the cause, but even if they're told what it is, they never seem to be following through. like, until somebody sits them down and says, okay, the McDowell checklist is a problem within the system. We need to eradicate that. The reporting system does not work. We need to change that system and include a civilian system. The criminal side of punishing the perpetrator is not working, and we need to make sure that the records of these sexual offenders, sexual predators, goes into the community. And I have not yet found someone who's willing to address all of these globally. They need a global overhaul. They don't need SARP and SAPRO, because the way it is now, it's useless.
I'm going to give you the most left-handed compliment in the world, which is that I wish people like you weren't as necessary as you are. And I wish I didn't hear as often as I have already how unique and wonderful and honorable and generous and loving and unusual you are. But boy, am I ever glad you are. And thank you so much for talking with us. You've certainly given us a lot to think about and put into this film service, the project.
And I hope veterans listening take your advice and find that social worker, make that phone call, and get the help you deserve and need.